debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
So my op-ed today over at HartmannReport.com is titled, Why America Must Prepare for a Decades-Long War Over Gun Control. What got me started thinking on this was I was reading a piece, one of these guys who consults with Democratic campaigns, and he was saying that people like me and elected officials, people like Congress and Pocan, should not be using the phrase gun control because that just triggers the people on the right. We should instead be talking about gun safety because everybody loves safety. Control, that's not such a happy word. I call BS. We absolutely need to control guns. Guns are, there are two products that are sold in America today that when used as directed cause death. Cigarettes and guns. And we need to control them both. Now, products have what you can call a life cycle or a product cycle that goes through a series of stages and sometimes quite predictably, particularly controversial or even deadly products like tobacco and guns. And we saw this with tobacco. Back in 1964, the U.S. Surgeon General came out and said tobacco is killing, you know, 500,000 Americans a year. Actually, I think the number that they were looking at back then was a couple hundred thousand. But it was enough to get some action going. So what happened? The tobacco industry fought back. They started a movement they called the Tea Party. That was who started the first Tea Party. It was the tobacco industry. And, you know, no more government regulations. But within a couple of decades, you had restaurants going smoke-free. You had airlines going smoke-free. You had federal laws requiring airlines to be smoke-free. That was in 2000. I think it was 1997 was when Delta, the last airline to allow smoking, banned all smoking on national and international flights. So we fought this battle. We fought it in the newspapers. We fought it in the workplace. We fought it everywhere. And ultimately sort of won. Got the tobacco industry to stop marketing to children. I mean, but there were hundreds of small battles along the way. And what I want to tell you is this is how it's going to be with gun control. It's not going to happen overnight. There's nothing that's going to happen this year in Congress, even if we, you know, reinstated the assault weapons ban, or even if we, you know, did, you know, comprehensive background checks and did away with the gun control loophole. There's nothing that's going to stop these mass shootings. Not over the short term. It's going to take some time. And we have to be prepared for a long war because the NRA is. You know, Harlan Carter, when he staged that coup in 1977 with the NRA, he knew what he was fighting for. Harlan Carter, he was the Wayne LaPierre of the 70s. When he was 17 years old, he murdered a 15-year-old or killed. He was convicted of murder and then he was acquitted later because they said the jury instructions were wrong. But he shot and killed a 15-year-old Hispanic boy that he thought had, with no evidence, had stolen a car. Turned out the kid hadn't, but he shot him anyway. He gut shot him with a shotgun. This was the guy who took over the NRA. He loved guns, and he sure knew what they could do in the hands of a pissed-off white boy. And that's where the NRA is at now. So get ready. This is not a battle we are going to fight and win in a year or a month. This is going to take a decade. But nonetheless, we have to engage in this. Lives are at stake. On Memorial Day, we memorialized, we remembered solemnly the deaths of 1.2 million Americans who volunteered or were conscripted to defend their country in wars going all the way back to the Revolutionary War. 1.2 million Americans have died in our wars. Just since 1978, 1.5 million Americans have died from guns. I mean, just let that sink in for a moment. This is not freedom. This is absolutely not freedom. And this explosion of gun violence, by the way, started in 1978. In 1977, there was an internal coup inside the NRA, and basically front men for the manufacturers and a bunch of right-wingers who thought that someday they'd want to fight a civil war in America against liberals took over the NRA. The next year, 1978, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations like the NRA could give basically unlimited amounts of money and other forms of support to political candidates and ballot initiatives. This was a decision called First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti. Frank Bilotti was the state attorney general in Massachusetts at the time. And they had this law that said that, you know, that banks couldn't put money into political campaigns unless they were specific around issues having to do with banking. And the same for any other industry. The Supreme Court struck that down. They struck down in the course of doing that, as Byron White noted, Justice White noted in his dissent, they struck down laws in 31 states, hundreds of laws, good government laws, in doing this. And of course, that gave the NRA then in 1978-79, gave them the legal right to own as many politicians as they want. And they've been buying them ever since. I mean, that decision also greased the skids for the Reagan Revolution in 1980. It was a decision, by the way, written by Lewis Powell himself, the author of the Powell Memo. And it said, the decision essentially said, well, corporations are persons. Persons have First Amendment rights under the Constitution, so a corporation has a right to speak. The problem is a corporation doesn't have a mouth, so we will rule, Lewis Powell and the Supreme Court said, we will rule that money is the same thing as speech. So if corporations want to spend money. And so now we've got big gun controlling our legislature, big pharma controlling our legislature, big church controlling our legislatures, big insurance controlling our legislatures, big oil controlling our legislatures, and it goes on and on and on. Now, there is a possibility, and I think this is a very real possibility, that between Republicans' united opposition to doing anything about guns in the United States, and I'm going to tell you on the other side of this break what Canada is doing, but there is a possibility that between Republicans clinging to their guns and Republicans asserting that pregnancy or that human life begins at the moment of conception, and that even rape and incest and life of the mother should not be considerations. Forced pregnancy now, forced pregnancy tomorrow, forced pregnancy forever, right? That between those two things, guns and abortion, that there are going to be a lot of people going to the polls this fall saying, I've had it with the GOP. If the Democrats succeed in seizing a significant majority in the House and Senate, if we can outnumber and outmaneuver Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, if we can add more than two more senators, and if we can hold on to our majority in the House, And we've already replaced one blue dog, Kurt Schrader, with a brand new progressive in all probability, Jamie McLeod Skinner here in Oregon. And there are others. Then I would like to argue here and now that the first order of business that Congress should address should be overturning Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision, and its predecessors, the Buckley decision in 76 and the Bilotti decision in 78. We are literally the only country on earth with more guns than citizens. We have over 400 million guns. We have 335 million people. More guns per person than literally any other country in the world. The closest to us is Yemen, which has about half as many guns per person as we do, a little over 50. We have over 110 guns per person. Most of your countries have, you know, a dozen or so guns per 100 people. The number of guns manufactured in America has nearly tripled just in the past 20 years, from 3.9 million in 2000 to 11.3 million in 2020. There were 118 school shootings in 2018. There were 249 last year. We've had 137 so far this year. We have half the year to go. And guns have become the leading cause of childhood death in America. More children die in the United States by gunfire in a year than on-duty police officers and active-duty military members. Now, these are the two groups, the two categories that we pay to stand in front of gunfire: cops and the Army and the military. And if you add all the police who died from gunfire last year and all the military who died from gunfire all over the world last year, it's still a smaller number than the number of children who have died in the United States from gunfire. There are 193 countries in the world, and in 183 of those countries, last year there were zero school shootings. Now, Canada had a problem with this in Nova Scotia. This was in 2020, 2 years ago. The guy went on a rampage. It was one of the deadliest in the history of Canada. 22 people were killed. And so Prime Minister Trudeau came out and he tweeted this. This, you can find it. In fact, I retweeted it. You can find it on my Twitter feed if you don't know how to find his, although his is at Justin Trudeau. It's fairly easy to find. He writes, again, the Prime Minister of Canada: "One Canadian killed by gun violence is one too many. That's why we have banned 1,500 types of military-style assault firearms. And that's why today we've introduced legislation to further strengthen gun control in Canada." Notice he calls it gun control. I'm hearing from Democrats, don't call it gun control, call it gun safety. Because we don't want to piss off the Republicans. We don't want to freak out the gun nuts. Screw the Republicans and the gun nuts. We've got to control guns in this country. Anyhow, back to Pierre Trudeau, or Justin Trudeau, excuse me. I'm showing my age. Pierre was his father. "Through this legislation," Justin Trudeau says, "we will move forward with a national freeze on handgun ownership. In other words, it will no longer be possible to buy, sell, transfer, or import handguns anywhere in Canada once this bill becomes law." So they're saying, okay, the number of guns we have in Canada right now, that's the most we're ever going to have. He goes on to say in his next tweet, he says, "We will also increase criminal penalties to combat gun smuggling and trafficking, provide authorities with more tools to investigate firearm crimes, and criminalize the modification of magazines to prevent them from holding more than the legal limit of ammunition." The legal limit, by the way, is 5. It is illegal in Canada to have a gun that shoots more than 5 bullets without reloading. With a semi-automatic weapon, although semi-automatic weapons, by and large, are banned now in Canada as well. But typically, you do that by changing the size of the magazine. With a revolver, you know, 5-shot revolver, right? In addition, he says, "we'll make sure that people involved in acts of domestic violence or criminal harassment have their firearms licenses taken away. And we'll make sure that those who are considered a danger to themselves or others have to surrender their firearms to authorities." He's also proposing a semi-automatic weapons buyback program in addition to a ban, like New Zealand did in 2019. In Australia, they had a mass shooting in 1996. They initiated a nationwide gun buyback program, and they bought back 650,000 semi-automatic rifles. New Zealand's was very successful. Canada is going to do this. That's it. What Canada calls military-style assault weapons, this is from the New York Times, would be required to turn over their firearms to a government buyback program under legislation introduced. The Canadian government also announced new regulations that will ban the sale, purchase, transportation, or transfer of handguns. In the United States, we have 120.5 firearms per 100 people. In Canada, it's 34.7 firearms per 100 people, which is still on the high end for most nations. They are taking steps in Canada. They are saying enough already. We should too.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Guns.
Yeah, go for it.
What we need to do first is ban the AR-15 and the AK-47 and make it illegal to own the thing in the United States the way it used to be. But if somebody wants to buy a pistol for home protection, the requirement instead of a permit should be a good graduation from a gun safety course put out by either your local law enforcement or the military. You keep talking about how the militia is in the Constitution, okay? All right, well, then you should join as a reserve either the deputies, you know, the county sheriff's department, the police department, or your local Army Reserve units and be ready to help the country when it's needed instead of just going out and buying a gun because you think you're a real bad you-know-what. And so if you're required to go get a certificate from one of the courses taught, ours is taught by the county sheriff's department here, and it's a very good course. And also there's a program called Becoming an Outdoor Woman where they teach gun safety. If you can't strip your gun down, clean it, and put it back together, and you don't understand line of fire, you should not be allowed to have a pistol of any kind. And you probably shouldn't have a rifle or a shotgun, because if you can't even figure out where you're aiming it, you have no business owning a gun. And I'm probably making every law enforcement agent in the country cry, because thinking about everybody having to have a gun safety course certificate. But this is the only way that I would be happy with my idiot neighbors owning pistols.
Yeah,
I know of two that go deer hunting, and they've been doing it since they were children, trained by their parents and their grandparents. But these people who think that just owning a pistol makes them tough, they've watched Bad Boys too many times.
Yeah, I'm with you, Norma. I'm with you. Thank you very much. Spot on. Rodney in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Rodney, what's up?
Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm well. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm an African-American. When black people own guns, it's a problem. Because it scares the white folks.
Just a quick history lesson for people who don't know what you and I are talking about. I've read this in Huey Newton's autobiography. Reagan was standing out on the steps of the state capitol in California when he was the governor. And California at the time was an open carry state, and Reagan was very proud of that. And Huey Newton and Bobby Seale and a half a dozen other guys, it was just a small bunch of them, you know, five, six, seven guys, got out of a car with a whole bunch of weapons. They were unloaded, actually, but, Reagan didn't know that. And so here are the 6-7 black guys walking up the steps of the state capitol where Reagan's standing here with his, you know, a collection of second graders and walking into the Capitol building. Reagan freaks out, and within 1 week, the California legislature has passed the Morrill Act, which ended open carry in California and made California the most restrictive state in the entire United States to own a gun at the time. That was, as you said, I think that was 66. It was in the 60s. Back to you, Rodney.
And then, you know, I lived in Texas for about 20 years, and I went to take a class. Cost me $40. I don't have a problem with gun control. As long as you take, just like the last lady just said, you got to be smart enough to, you know, pick the gun back together and clean it.
Yeah.
He said the most problem what people have is, the reason why they get killed or injured is when they're cleaning the damn gun.
Oh, really? Well, that's interesting. Yeah,
yeah,
it makes a lot of sense. You hear about those accidents.
And here, from Oklahoma to Texas, they done dropped everything's open carry. You don't have to have license. Any kid can go get a gun.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Yeah, I'm completely with you. Rodney, thank you very much. Very well said. Alejandro in Miami. Hey, Alejandro, what's up?
Well, I'm from Florida, so you can imagine, you know, how crazy our gun laws are. And, you know, obviously after the Parkland shootings, you know, the Florida legislature, which was all Republicans dominated, actually passed the gun laws. He passed our own version of the red flag law that allows, you know, judges to, you know, they have hearings to determine if people are too dangerous to carry guns and stuff like that. So I think that's great, you know. The problem is that it seems like we go one step forward, two steps back, because our governor thinks it's a good idea to push constitutional carry, which is just a fancier way of saying that just permitless gun ownership. Like everyone can, it's free for all. Everyone can have whatever gun you want. You can carry it in public. You could be concealed or openly displayed. You don't even have to register it. There's no mandatory training or licensing required. So it's a free-for-all.
Right. So it's the Wild West, except the Wild West wasn't like that. In the Wild West, you used to have to check your guns with the local sheriff's office.
Yeah, isn't that the irony? Yeah, it's just insane. Like, exactly, like what you're saying earlier. I mean, I think DeSantis cares more about our feelings than our safety. You know, why is he pushing such a stupid idea? If anything, if we should emulate any country's regime, it should be like what Switzerland has, where, you know, if you're familiar with Swiss gun laws, that's more strict and more regulation on who can carry guns. And everyone who has a gun in Switzerland has to go through extensive training, and pretty much all men of military age have to serve in the military.
Right.
You know,
right.
Exemption.
Yeah, they do have a militia. Yes. Excellent points, Alejandro. I am with you 100%. Thank you. George in Cripple Creek, Virginia. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. How are you? I'd like to talk to you about, you know, the concerns about Canadian U.S. intelligence sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was U.S. Army and NSA Soviet communications analyst for 26 years, and our closest partners were Canada and UK, followed by Australia and New Zealand. And a couple times in the 80s, I went to the Canucus Conference in Ottawa, where we met with our Canadian and UK counterparts and gave presentations on intelligence. So Canada is one of our closest intelligence sharing partners.
Right. Right. Are they part of the, is it called Four Eyes or Five Eyes?
Five Eyes, yeah. That's U.S., Canada, Canada, U.K., Australia, and New Zealand.
New Zealand, all,
the,
yeah.
Five English-speaking countries.
Five English-speaking countries, right, okay. So so George, I'm assuming you're responding to the piece that I opened the show with about 2.5 hours ago, talking about how Canada...
Right.
The Canadian intelligence services are freaked out about the possibility that we could lose democracy in America, and this poison could spread across the border. You think that's a legitimate fear?
If that happens, they'd cut off a lot of intelligence cooperation with us.
Yeah. Okay. Josh, Minneapolis. Hey, Josh. It says here you disagree with me about what?
The thought process of the people who wrote the Constitution and the Second Amendment. I would love for you to be—I'll be one of those guys with a coffee mug and sign saying "Prove me wrong." You're going to have to explain it to me. I don't see how, given that these people just overthrew a government that was oppressive, they had to use their guns in order to do that. Why they would not be thinking when they wrote in the Second Amendment that hey, we're going to need to use the same weapons that the government might have if we ever need to do this again. And they are of the understanding that a government can become so oppressive. in order to do that.
Sure. The reason that they weren't thinking like that. It's a good and serious question, Josh. The reason they weren't thinking like that and they weren't talking like that, and I encourage you to go back and read Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. He took copious notes, and in particular, the notes on the Virginia ratifying convention, which was the convention where they ratified they were debating whether or not to adopt the Constitution. The Constitution was written in the summer of 1787. The Virginia ratifying convention was summer of 1788. And in the fall of 1789 is when the Constitution was adopted and we became a country. And then 2 years later, or 3 years later, 1791, is when we got the Bill of Rights, which included the Second Amendment. But the Second Amendment was passed around, the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, were passed around with the Constitution in 1788. And it became a huge topic of discussion at the Virginia Ratifying Convention because of the objections of Patrick Henry. So, number one, in answer to your question, just a straight-up answer to your question, the reason why they didn't think that they would ever have to have guns to overthrow the government of the United States is because it was a completely different type of government. They were creating a democracy. They had overthrown a kingdom. Kingdoms are completely, consequentially, totally different kinds of governments. Democracies, these guys were true believers. They believed that a democracy would survive. They believed that a democracy would produce the very best outcome, and that a democracy would have to defend itself. And in fact, there were a couple of rebellions. Shays' rebellion is probably the most famous, that where George Washington and his buddies put down the rebellions. So they definitely weren't thinking about, gee, we want a little rebellion. Thomas Jefferson's comments when he was in Paris about the French Revolution, periodically the tree of liberty needs to be watered with the blood of patriots. He was speaking of the French Revolution in support of the French Revolution. Those comments notwithstanding, nobody among the founding generation was saying, someday in the future, this government that we're creating, we, the people, are going to have to destroy. Just didn't happen.
So you honestly
wasn't even part of the conversation.
You honestly believe that.
No, this is a matter of belief. I wrote a book about this, Josh, and all the footnotes and all the references are in it. It's called The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. I spent a year researching it, and I'm telling you, this isn't my belief. This is the actual history. I don't know what kind of feedback you got going on there, but turn it down. So number one, there were two issues at debate with regard to the Second Amendment. The first was that Jefferson and his contingent, what ultimately became the Democratic Republican Party, today's Democratic Party, back then there were no political parties at the time that this was written. The Federalist was the first party to emerge, and that was at the tail end of the George Washington administration. So back then, the big fear when the Constitution was being written was not that our government would become oppressive. The big fear was, generally speaking, that the military within our government could overthrow the government. They had seen governments in Europe that had been quasi or semi-democratic, where the power of the king had been reduced, the power of the legislature had been increased. Holland was probably, the Netherlands, one of the better examples of that. It wasn't one of the ones that suffered an internal military coup. But they had seen this over and over through 1,000 years of history, that when governments got overthrown, they were almost never overthrown by the people. They were almost always overthrown by the military. And so the argument that Jefferson put forward, and he was so outspoken about this, is at least a dozen letters he wrote about this, including to the convention and including to published in newspapers and everything, was that we should not have a standing army during a time of peace, because a standing army is the mother of all mischief. It was his phrase, that a standing army has the potential to rise up and overthrow the country, a military coup, like what happened in Egypt just a couple of years ago. And so his solution to that, and there was this huge debate about how do we prevent a standing army from being a threat to a nation? And his solution was, don't have a standing army during times of peace. Only have every state have a militia, the equivalent of what we would today call the National Guard, and during a time of national emergency, the federal government, the president, can call up those state militias, and that's in the Constitution. It's in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And so Jefferson argued we should have no standing army. We should have a standing navy. And in fact, again, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution specifically says we can have a navy. But in the, and this is the amazing thing, Josh, there's only one place in the entire Constitution where the ability of Congress to raise money and spend money is time limited. Only one place in the whole Constitution. And it's in Article 1, Section 8, and it says that no appropriation, I'm doing this from memory, but this is pretty close, no appropriation for funding the army shall last more than 2 years. It's right there in the Constitution. And it's still the law today. Congress can appropriate all the money they want for the Pentagon, but it cannot extend for more than a 2 year period. At the end, so in other words, it forced Congress every 2 years to decide, do we want to have a military or do we want to have all these state militias that the president can call up? And that was the conclusion that they came to. When Jefferson came into office, there were over 400,000 men in the U.S. Army. Actually, I think the number was like 370,000. It was in the neighborhood of 400,000 men in the U.S. Army when Jefferson became president in 1801, in March of 1801. He dialed that back to around 6,000 people because he wanted to get rid of the standing army. So by the time he left office in 1809, in January or March of 1809, our army was gone. We had a very strong navy at that point. But we had basically no army, which is why and how the British and the Canadians could just march in from Quebec and burn the White House down in the War of 1812. And so that whole debate about whether we should have a standing army or not, which was a hot, hot, hot debate from the 1770s right up until the end of the Jefferson presidency, that debate ended with the War of 1812. Because after the War of 1812, in 1815, when that war was resolved, everybody agreed, we need to have a standing army. And we have had a standing army ever since. So that was one of the reasons why, that was the main reason, that was 90% of why the Second Amendment was written the way it was, why it was put in the Constitution the way it was, to prevent a standing army and provide a backup being the state militias. The second reason the Second Amendment was altered in that Virginia ratifying convention, James Madison was there. He is the father of the Constitution. He was shopping around this stuff, you know, with the Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment. And Patrick Henry, who was the largest slaveholder in Virginia, gets up and gives this long speech in which he points out that there's over 300,000 black people in Virginia, and they're all enslaved. And if they ever rise up against the state, the white people in Virginia are screwed. And the thing that could end the ability of Virginia to keep those black people in enslavement would be if the federal government called up their militia for just for the hell of it. If the president was an abolitionist and he said, I'm going to end slavery in Virginia, if they got an Abraham Lincoln in the White House, all he had to do is call up the Virginia militia, because the Virginia militia was also the Virginia Slave Patrol. And so the original Second Amendment said, for the security of a free nation. And in deference to Patrick Henry, James Madison changed that language to for the security of a free state, so that the individual states, there were four states at the time that had militias that were also simultaneously slave patrols, Georgia, South Carolina, Virginia, and I believe the other one was Alabama. I could be wrong. It's in my book. And that's the history of the Second Amendment. None of it had to do with thinking, gee, maybe someday in the future, we're going to need to kill politicians in America. Never even discussed. Josh, thanks for a great question.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Product liability for the gun industry. And if you don't mind me plugging my latest written piece, you can find it on Medium.com or on Facebook. Just search for No Free Lunch for Gun Makers. No Free Lunch for Gun Makers on Medium.com or on Facebook. And here, you can read the details, but I'll go through the ideas. First, let's review where we've been in the last 30 years. In 1994, the Democrats who had control of Congress and Bill Clinton passed the assault weapons ban. And it was a 10-year bill, expired in 2004. But remember, in 1994, the Democrats also lost the Congress. They lost both the House and the Senate because the Republicans, one of the things they said, that was the contract on America, Newt Gingrich, and they, one of the things they were saying is, oh, they want to take away your guns. And in fact, that was kind of true. We took away assault weapons. That's a good thing, but there's another way to go about it, because when the bill expired, when the assault weapons ban expired, straight away, the Republican Congress under George W. Bush passed a law called, and write this down because I want you to call your representatives in Congress, to repeal, it's called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. The Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. And what that does is exempt the gun industry from strict product liability. And what that means is strict product liability applies to every product that's sold in this country. What it means is that all that need to be shown is that the product caused the injury or the damage. It has nothing to do with fault, with intended use. With intended and normal use, the product caused the damage. Now, every one of those victims last week and the week before, and every victim is the cause of injury and death is ballistic trauma. That's caused by a gun. That's all that need be. But when they don't have liability, here's what they don't have to do. Every product, to a lesser or greater extent, has what's called externalities or damages to society. A pizza maker might charge a few cents more for a pizza for the occasional olive pit that ends up on a pizza, and somebody breaks a tooth on it. And that might be $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 to fix your tooth. That's not huge, but they throw in a few cents to cover that. And it's called internalizing the cost.
They Dennis Kucinich broke a tooth eating an olive in a restaurant and sued for thousands of dollars and won. So, yes.
I remember that. that's right. And the industry covers that. But what the gun industry doesn't have to do is internalize the cost. Internalize means they have their own insurance policy. They put money aside for it for the damages that cause. So if you look at the hundreds of thousands of people that have been injured by guns over the past 17 years since we've had this act, just take the Las Vegas shooting alone. 587 people were shot. 59 were shot dead. Can you imagine 587 tort suits against the maker of that rifle? That would put them out of business. But see, what they would have to do, internalizing those costs would you couldn't buy an AR-15 for $700 to $1,200, depending on the bells and whistles. That rifle would be $2,500 or $3,000, and sales would go down. And I'll tell you something else about gun buyback, is that if this becomes a rifle that's too expensive to make, they'll quit making it because it's too much, and they will also be the ones to buy the guns back to get them off the street so they don't keep having lawsuits. That's why we have to take this approach. It is the number one, and it's a free market strategy.
Yeah, repeal their limitations on liability. I totally get it. And I didn't realize that was passed in 2004 when the assault weapons ban expired.
It was the next year. It was 2005.
And that protects not just gun manufacturers. That protects retailers as well, correct?
Yeah, and see, the major, this is what's wrong, if I could just continue quickly. The major argument, I went on, before I wrote this piece, I looked online, on YouTube, to see what the right wing thought about this. And their major argument is essentially they argue what used to be called the privity rule, which means that the buyer and the seller have an essential relationship, an essential business relationship. And if you don't have that relationship, which a criminal doesn't, they argue that the chain of ownership of a lot of these rifles is so long that, how can you hold the gun industry responsible, especially when it ends up in the hands of a criminal? But you see, That privity rule was blown up by Benjamin Cardozo over 100 years ago. He used a case from 1852 that had to do with an apothecary, a pharmacist who received a mislabeled poison that he distributed, and the court back in 1852 said there is no privity rule for inherently dangerous products. You don't have to have you can't just sell or sue the seller. You are the manufacturer's directly liable. And then Cardozo came along and said, wait a minute, any product that causes injury is inherently dangerous, okay? Or it wouldn't be causing injury. So he blew that up, and ever since we have had the history of product liability has become strict liability, and every product except guns is subject to it. And the thing is that it is wholly un-American and a violation of free market principles to let one industry off the hook. And this is the industry that causes more externalities, more damage to society than all of the others combined.
With the possible exception of the fossil fuel industry.
We did it because we weren't paying attention. We don't have to argue Second Amendment because they're going to say you're taking, and that's what they want us to do. They want us to argue about taking away their guns when they slip past this. This is just a civil liability law that's where it really counts. We don't have to argue a Second Amendment if we just go where the money is and hold them liable. And this, all we have to do, and please do call your representatives in Congress and the Senate, which is 202-224-3121. House is 202-225-3121, and tell them repeal the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act now. That's our number one legislative agenda.
Or if you want a simpler way to say it, just say end gun industry immunity.
Correct. They like that when end that now, and that's why I wrote the piece that says no free lunch for gun makers. You can find that on medium.com or on YouTube.
Okay.
On Facebook.
That's quite all right. Good on you, Paul. Thank you very much for the details. It's always nice to hear from you. Judy in Bismarck, North Dakota. Hey, Judy, what's on your mind today?
We keep hearing this school, that school, Sandy Hook, same thing. They couldn't recognize the kids because they were shot to pieces. I heard a while ago they were doing DNA testing on the children in Uvalde.
Yep.
You know, if they showed pictures of these messes and let that out so people could see what this looks like, they would change those gun laws overnight. I'm sure of it.
I have been singing this song for at least a decade. I completely agree with you, Judy. In fact, I wrote an op-ed a year ago saying America needs an Emmett Till moment. Emmett Till's mother made this incredible, difficult decision to have an open casket funeral and to invite Jet Magazine and invite the press. Jet Magazine was the only one that did it, to take pictures of her son. And that arguably was one of the major catalysts for the civil rights movement of the late 50s and early 60s.
And I think they can refer to that today.
Yeah. And I am waiting for a parent to have the courage to say, I'm going to do an open casket funeral for my child. You know, I can't imagine being that parent, the horror of it. I just can't imagine it. But something's got to break this fever.
But it would have shut Alex Jones up with his stuff. It didn't happen. Just a picture or two.
There you go.
He wouldn't have had anywhere to go.
There you go. Judy, thank you. Don in Baldwin, Iowa. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
I've been thinking about liability of the weapons sellers. And I got a story to tell you about something that happened here in Iowa back in the 80s. DUI turned into a liability case. Up-and-coming Roxanne Conlon, she was a lawyer and governor aspirational candidate, got wind of an off-duty police officer who went in pursuit of a suspected under-the-influence driver. Subsequently, got into a near-fatal accident. The DUI candidate was still apprehended, but the off-duty police officer suffered life-threatening injuries. He survived, but could not get workman's comp. His insurance did not cover his activities in that wreck. And so, nearly going bankrupt, Roxanne Conlon took the case and said, suppliers of the beer first was the Hy-Vee store and the chain with hundreds of employee-owned stores. This company was waist-deep in lawyers, and Roxanne decided to go after the convenience store that sold the last beer to him.
Right. So she's going down the chain of liability here. So is there a, are you getting to a parallel with guns on this?
Yes, I am. Convenience store was found guilty of selling the beer that made him drunk, no matter that he drank beer before he bought beer there. So what I'm basically saying is the store was liable selling the beer. The cashier was partially liable, and the store closed down. They lost their whole business, and she lost her job. In this case, the people that sold the AR-15, the salesman in this case, he didn't have any accountability. The NRA doesn't. The manufacturer of the AR-15 doesn't have any liability. The ammo manufacturer doesn't have any liability. But the case that I talked to you about, the store had liability for selling the beer.
Right.
And I'm making the correlation that the store that sold the AR-15 has liability.
Back in the day, and I frankly don't know when this happened. It's in my book someplace, but I don't recall the details off the top of my head. But back in the day, Congress, or shall we say Republicans in Congress, by and large, passed legislation guaranteeing liability from lawsuits to the manufacturers of guns. I could be wrong, but I believe that that limitation of liability extends to people who sell guns. Whether it only extends to licensed gun dealers or not, I frankly don't know. It's been 3 years since I did a deep dive into this topic. This is why the Sandy Hook or the Newtown kids, somebody went after the Remington, you'll recall, and the only thing they could convict them of was marketing fraud, basically. So I think that's the problem, Don. I'm going to have to learn a little more about this. I'm with you. There should be liability all over the place on this. And if there isn't, at the very least, we should be requiring liability insurance for people who have guns. Carol in Eureka, Montana. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind today?
A buyback program is something that I think should be initiated. But then to give some incentive, I'm wondering if the executive branch had the power to tax, put a levy or a tax on assault weapons, say a big amount, maybe $1,000 a year. And so I looked it up online, and it says that the executive branch does have a statutory way to a power to tax, but that they don't use it very often because Congress usually passes any revenue measures. But if they were to implement that statutory power to tax and then offered to buy back the weapons, or if not, then you're going to have to pay $1,000 a year to keep them in your possession. And then to enforce that, let's have the neighborhood snitch program go into effect, which Texas is perfecting with the abortion. And that is, if somebody snitches, they get $100 or whatever it is, and then somebody comes to your door and gives you a bill for $1,000 if you don't say that you have an assault weapon.
Yeah, I get what
so
you're
I'm
saying,
calling
Carol.
You to find out if that's doable.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, and I like, you know, it's kind of an elegant logic. My understanding, and I'm not sure what you found online or what it said, but my understanding is that the Constitution gives Congress the right to levy taxes, and that
right.
and then the executive branch executes that authority. In other words, the executive branch runs the IRS, for example, or in the case of taxes on guns, and there are taxes. There's, you know, if you want to own a machine gun, you have to pay I believe it's an annual license fee to own a machine gun. You can, you know, they're legal. You have to jump through a lot of hoops. They're really hard to get, but it's legal. Whether that could be applied to other kinds of weapons or not, I'm real skeptical. I could be wrong. But I'm guessing that Congress would have to specifically authorize either the ATF or the IRS or however it would be done to attach a tax to, you know, the types of weapons that you want to target. I would be very general. I'd say all semi-automatic weapons, but whatever.
Maybe call it something else instead of a tax. Call it a bonus or a levy or a whatever.
Well, then it may be even more problematic
because
that was the whole basis of the Supreme Court inserting itself into the Affordable Care Act was, you know, is that fee, that $90 a year fee that you have to pay if you don't have health insurance, is that a tax or is that a fee? And they ultimately decided, and this was John Roberts' thing, he said it's a tax and Congress gives us the power to tax or gives, you know, that's how he saved, actually, the Affordable Care Act.
But, oh, those little sneaks, yeah, they'll get around it. Yeah, well, anyway, I just thought I would run that by you because it did say that the executive branch did have a power, but they didn't use it very often.
Yeah, so. Great idea. Well, Carol, thank you. Thanks for the flag on that. Let me see what I can learn about it.
Thanks for all you do.
My
pleasure. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Carol. Good talking with you. Well, there was a guilty plea in California. This was the attempted firebombing of the headquarters of the California Democratic Party. Pretty serious about committing domestic terrorism. And what's got me scratching my head is, why wasn't he convicted of domestic terrorism? I'm guessing it's probably because we don't have an effective domestic terrorism law. Because every time anybody brings one up, a whole bunch of Republicans come out and go, oh, no, 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 no. But this is the Associated Press. A California man pleaded guilty to plotting to blow up the state Democratic Party's headquarters in what prosecutors said was the first in a planned series of politically motivated attacks after the defeat of former President Donald Trump. This guy is 46 years old. His name was Ian Benjamin Rogers. He lived in Napa. He pleaded guilty to conspiring to destroy a building by fire or explosive, possessing an explosive device, possessing a machine gun. He's looking at the possibility of 9 years in prison. They haven't done the sentencing yet. He also had a compatriot, a fellow by the name of Jared Copeland, and they were convicted of conspiring to attack targets that they associated with Democrats. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Remember Tim McVeigh? When Tim McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City building, the federal building in Oklahoma City, killing hundreds of children, there was a daycare center in there, in addition to maybe it was dozens of children and over 100 citizens. When Tim McVeigh did that, he had recently read this book called The Turner Diaries, which is a novel in which a group of patriots who see the country sliding into communism, this group of patriots blow up a federal building. And my recollection is, and I read the book back in the 80s, the 90s, whenever it came out, when it was a big deal. My recollection is they blew up the FBI building, but I could be wrong. But in any case, these patriots, they blew up a federal building, and the response of the federal government was to take away everybody's guns, to say, why? You just blew up a federal building, so we're going to outlaw explosives, we're going to outlaw guns, and we're going to put an end to this. And of course, the good patriots all across the country rose up, took down the government, and in the process killed all the black people, all the Hispanic people, all the Jews, probably a few Catholics. And in the end, it's, you know, white Protestants rule the country. And Tim McVeigh believed that by doing the exact same thing, by blowing up a federal building, he would start a revolution, start a movement. Well, that is what Ian Benjamin Rogers believed, too. The Turner Diaries is still out there and widely read by these people, as is now Camp of the Saints, another one. This was a French novel, and it's about the white replacement theory, about the efforts of government to replace white people with mostly black people who are portrayed in Camp of the Saints book as, shall we say, less than human. These are very popular pieces of literature on the right. You find them for sale at gun shows, for example. Frequently. And this is where it gets interesting. Ian Benjamin Rogers and Jared Copeland, who blew up tried to blow up the Democratic headquarters in California, quote, hoped their attacks would prompt a movement, according to federal prosecutors. Rogers wrote in one of the messaging apps that he used to communicate with Copeland, he said, I want to blow up a Democrat building bad. We go to war. This was, again, because Joe Biden was elected president. When they searched his home in January of last year, they found 50 firearms, thousands of rounds of ammunition, and 5 pipe bombs. Which brings me to the second point and how this all ties in with guns. And that is that gun ownership in the United States, the number of guns that are owned in the United States, has gone up over the last decade. The number of people who own guns, though, according to some reports, now the problem with this is that we don't know for sure because the Dickey Amendment makes it illegal for the federal government to collect this kind of information. This would be the kind of thing that the Centers for Disease Control, it's a public health issue, right? 45,000 Americans die from guns. I think in Canada last year it was 337, as I recall. It was in today's New York Times. But 45,000 here in the United States. From some of the numbers that we're seeing, it suggests that the number of gun owners as a percentage of the population is going down. The number of gun owners as an absolute number is going up. But our population is also growing. And the number of gun owners as a percentage of the population has been going down, while the number of guns the average gun owner owns has been going up. In other words, people are getting ready for war. The people who are holding guns, or at least some of them, a small cohort of them. This is something that I think that, frankly, we should be paying a little more attention to. The other story that I wanted to share with you that I think is a big deal, and this is the optimism for the day. We had this guy, Kurt Schrader, here in Oregon, who was a member of the House of Representatives. He got reelected over and over and over again. He had big money behind him, mostly from the pharmaceutical industry. His father was a pharmaceutical executive, a wealthy executive with, as I recall, Pfizer, one of the big pharma companies anyway. He was part of the coalition that stopped Build Back Better. And he voted against in the House of Representatives and fought any effort to allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices. Two things that, you know, the majority of people in his district didn't go along with. So when the primary election came along this year, he figured, I got millions and millions of dollars, you know, from these big donors. I'll be doing just fine. And along comes Jamie McLeod Skinner, who says, no, you know, you're not doing what we the people want, and I'm going to call you out on this. She was on this program calling him out. I called him out in 3 or 4 of my op-eds and multiple times on the air. I broke my own rule, except that I didn't. My rule with regard to endorsing in primaries is I don't endorse primary candidates unless I know them and their district. Now, I don't know Kurt Schrader personally, nor Jamie McLeod Skinner personally, but I know the 5th Congressional District. It starts just about 10 miles south of me here, maybe 20, something like that. You know, so I know the area and I know the issues. And I know that Kurt Schrader had been coasting on people not paying attention to what he was doing. And Jamie McLeod Skinner started campaigning in the district and calling him the Joe Manchin of the House of Representatives. Joe Manchin, of course, is in the Senate. And it stuck. And 4 county, as I recall, it might have been 3, but I'm pretty sure it was 4 county Democratic parties, including 2 of the counties that Schrader's running in. And if my recollection is correct, 2 counties that he wasn't running in came out and explicitly endorsed Jamie McLeod Skinner over Kurt Schrader. Well, they finally finished counting the ballots last Friday, and I was not live on the air on Friday, so I couldn't share this with you. But they have concluded that McLeod Skinner, who was, by the way, was endorsed by Elizabeth Warren, Schrader had been endorsed by Joe Biden. They called the election now for Jamie McLeod Skinner. He is the 2nd member of the so-called Unbreakable 9. This is a group of House Democrats who helped tank Build Back Better in the House. Another one, Carolyn Bordeaux, a Democrat of Georgia, also a member of the Blue Dog Coalition. She lost a primary race earlier this week to Representative Lucy McBath, a progressive. Progressives are winning. It's a good news. It appears to me, you know, you've heard me talk before about these 80-year cycles that Strauss and Howe wrote about in their book, The Fourth Turning, how these 80-year cycles come about. I think that there's a smaller cycle within the larger cycle. And I think we're transitioning into one right now. I think it's happening, and it gives me considerable cause for optimism, even in the context of my earlier comment that when Republicans win, rich people win, and when Democrats win, it's just we the people who win.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In other words, even in the face of great wealth, great money, great political forces, progressivism is winning right now. Dave in Hoffman Estates, Illinois. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Last hour, I was out working in the yard listening, and you had a caller, if I heard correctly, and he was, like, kind of being dismissive of the bullet that was being used that murdered those kids. And I know you got back at saying that, my God, they had to do DNA and all of this stuff because some of these were so disfigured from it. And, you know, because I believe he was saying, well, it's 223, you know, like it's a juiced up 22.
Oh, I think he was just kind of displaying his expertise.
Yeah, well, it was a 55-grain bullet. It's the casing behind it that the charge that it sends it over 3,200 feet per second.
Right.
That bullet.
Which is faster than the speed of sound.
Yeah, and they incorporated it during Vietnam at the beginning because it was lighter, you know, for the soldiers to carry. And if they hit the VC or the enemy, say they hit them in the shoulder, it'd ricochet off of the bone because, you know, and you didn't know where it'd come out. It could come out in the abdomen. It could come out in the thigh.
Right. It was more deadly.
Yeah. You know, some people have thought, it comes tumbling out of the barrel. Don't tumble out of the barrel. It's when it hits something because there's
right.
a rifling in it. Then that demon that did the killing, you know, like it's been said before already, that the gun probably costed somewhere around $700 each, and he got two of them. And he also had seven extra clips at about $30 a clip.
Yeah.
And the bullets, like I've had this catalog magazine thing that, you know, that you could buy the guns, clips, all the stuff, and that, and you could get, say, like for 500 rounds, it cost $350 or roughly for 500 rounds, and I understand, I think he had more even.
Yeah.
But,
you know, some of these gun shops and some of the manufacturers, in fact, are now offering financing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, no money down.
They need to do, like, years back, I had mentioned, too, you need a micro etch, or else I guess they got, like, micro stamp these
yeah.
bullets.
Yeah, I agree. And there's ways to do that. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator's sport. So get out there, get active, tag your it. Yes, this is going to take all of us, and I think we have an extraordinary opportunity this fall. I really and truly do. I'm more optimistic than I've been in years. Be good to yourself and the people around you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.